This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba Through the Hour, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Our number is 800-462-7413. And Zorba, in addition to the call, some interesting research to keep around.
Yes, research on obesity and the ads that the federal government is sponsoring to try to reduce the plague of obesity that we have in our society. Are they good ads or are they worthless?
Some people are saying they're too wimpy.
They may be too wimpy, too wussy.
And
Alzheimer's disease. Well, my mom had Alzheimer's disease, and it may be that among the well-educated, it's a bigger bugaboo than it is among those who do not have lifelong learning.
And an interesting recipe, a camping recipe, and we'll be on the phone with a buddy of yours.
Absolutely. A buddy from Canyons, which is an organization in Idaho that does wonderful trips that I went on a number of years ago, and this is a dynamite recipe.
Our medical myth buster this time around has to do with the flu shot, so you'll want to stay tuned for that. Again, 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And Zorba, a listener with us now in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi there.
What's up?
Well, I have what I think are shingles. About 3 weeks ago, my thigh was tingling and a little itchy, and the next morning I had a large rash area. Originally, I thought it was poison ivy, and after further investigation, I figured out it was shingles. But my real question is, what caused this? I really don't want to get it again. I almost have it under control.
Did you figure this out on your own, or did you go to a doc who said this is shingles, or...
I heard someone talking on television, an interview, mentioning that they had been under stress, and they mentioned they had shingles, and I thought, I wonder if that's what I have. I looked it up on the internet and found pictures, and I'm sure that's what it is. But my real question is I'm wondering if this could be brought on by a heavy workout or a fitness regimen that involves working out on specially designed weight machines where you push your muscles to exhaustion, because I started doing that 3 months ago.
Yeah, stop doing that.
Right? I'm feeling great now.
Get to the couch, turn on the TV, and those shingles are gone. History.
Wouldn't that be great?
That's it. No workout from now on. Couch potato and life is good. That's all. Life is good.
Clark Health System.
Clark Health System, right. No exercise. Get the remote. Buzz out. That's it. Exactly, yeah. Well, you know, you bring up an interesting point. First of all, shingles is the chickenpox virus reactivated. So
is shingles singular?
Shingles is singular.
Shingles is, not yeah, shingles. Shingles are.
Shingles are. No, it's called shingles. That's the name of the
disease. It's an S, so it should be plural.
Yes, it should. Who knows where it comes from? Who knows? The grammar police know, and they'll undoubtedly let us know. There's no doubt about it.
I would say shingles are, but I'm not a medical guy.
Shingles are a... No, shingles...
Shingles...
You know, that's it. Shingles.
When you have shingles, you don't care.
Now I'm totally confused.
Sorry.
But anyway, the shingles, now I've made it singular.
Okay.
No matter what.
All right.
Is a medical problem caused by the chickenpox virus that has lived dormant in your body. Now, let me explain. If you're a young person who received the chickenpox vaccine, and the chickenpox vaccine has been on the market maybe a dozen years, that's all, a dozen, 15 years max, but I think it's been a dozen years, those people won't get shingles because they were vaccinated. They never got the virus, the chickenpox virus. But for everyone else in the country, and that's probably 250 million people or 200 million people, we all got the chickenpox virus, 98% of us when we were young. We fought chickenpox, but the virus is in our body dormant, waiting to pop up when we get older. And what pops it up basically is age. That's what it is. There are things, anything that reduces the immunity of the body will allow the virus to pop up. So let's give an example. HIV/AIDS. Good example of how you can get shingles. That can be the presenting symptom of HIV/AIDS, can be shingles. As you get older, generally your immunity tends to drop, and so age is a huge issue. It's much more common as you get older. But there are other things that do it. Now, there's no hard and fast evidence that stress does it. Clearly, a workout doesn't do it. But on the other hand, sometimes stress reduces your body ability to fight things. So, you know, that might be a minor player. Frankly, we don't know what activates it. We just know as you get older, the chances are it's going to be activated more and more. And by the way, there is a shingles vaccine now that's on the market that I am now recommending, and Medicare is now paying for senior citizens, and the vaccine reduces the chances that you'll get shingles by something like 85 or 90%, huge amount, because the vaccine boosts that immunity that tends to wane as you get older.
Since I've had this breakout, would I be eligible for taking the vaccine?
No, not at all. You wouldn't do it. You've had the breakout. The breakout does it.
Okay.
The breakout is actually doing it. The breakout is probably more effective than the vaccine. So I would not recommend it. And at this point, I don't think there's any evidence that that's where the vaccine would work. You're kind of self-vaccinating yourself as it pops up. But there are a lot of old wives' tales about shingles and what pops up, because there's a randomness to what actually did it. And so you randomly had bad luck. That's what it is.
Well, maybe it was good luck in the long run.
There you go, because you don't have much pain. So,
great.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
I've got these little white spots under my eyes, like on my under eye where you get the wrinkles and things. They're little white dots, and they don't have anything in them. They're hard. Somebody said they were calcium deposits, or in my self-diagnosing. I have figured out on the Internet maybe they're calcium deposits, but it never says what to do.
Are they just like no pigment in the skin, or do they feel different than the skin?
No, they feel different. You can feel them under there.
How long have you had them?
Just a couple months.
Uh-huh. Well, it's interesting. Discoloration around the eye can be a number of things. And there are deposits around the eye, which are actually cholesterol deposits. And they can appear to be, they usually have a slightly yellow tint. And I mention it because it's one of the places the cholesterol is deposited, not just in the arteries, but in other parts of the body, including the skin. And so sometimes people will come in and say, what's this under my eye? And they have a high cholesterol, and you've got to have that cholesterol checked. And so this may be, it is a possibility that it's a cholesterol deposit. Another possibility is that, and calcium is pretty unlikely. Calcium deposits would tend to be kind of firm, and calcium would not be the likely thing that I would think that would be in there. But sometimes you can actually have the glands, the sweat glands, if you will, the oily glands within the skin can actually be plugged, almost like acne. And acne, when you've got acne, you start out often with a sort of a white plug that then oxidizes and becomes a black plug. And so that's when you look at teenagers, they often have whiteheads and blackheads. And so this can be a variation of that. And the treatment for that would be to go and get a peroxide, you know, such as Brevoxo, which is one of them, 5 or 10%, Oxy-5, Oxy-10, from the pharmacy or from your department store. Just put that on your eye for a few days and see what happens. Not on the eye, rather underneath the eye in the skin, and see whether or not that clears it up. And that's cheaper than going to the doctor and getting the cholesterol checked. But if it doesn't clear it up, I think I'd have somebody look at it, because you want to know whether or not this is a cholesterol deposit.
What do I do if it is calcium?
Well, there's not much you can do. I mean, you know, there's not actually much you can do, which is why I recommend you try the acne medication, because you want to see if there's something you can do. You know, as a doctor, I don't like saying, well, there's nothing we can do. Please come back if you have trouble. That's always very negative. You know, we're in the field where let's try this. Let's try that. So, okay, so let's now see what you learned. You went to the web. It said calcium deposits. What did they say on the web?
Well, they just said, you know, what they described it as little white bumps that are hard, everything in them, and they said that was more likely calcium, but they, again, didn't tell you what to do.
Uh-huh. Well, you see, you didn't know. What you have to do is Google calcium deposit skin treatment, and you will probably come up with 10 or 20 different treatments, many of them costing a lot of money in order to get rid of the calcium deposits in the skin. But, once again, I don't have the diagnosis. I would initially try an acne-type medication that basically has, you know, a Brevoxo type medication, which is Oxy-5, Oxy-10, is your common name. See if that works.
Okay. Thank you.
You're
sure.
Welcome.
Thanks
Good
a
luck.
Lot. We appreciate the call. at 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's talk about those ads that the U.S. government are putting on television for obesity.
Yeah,
some are
they
saying they're very namby-pamby. They don't really attack the issue.
Namby-pamby. Remember, you know, this is your mind on drugs, and this is your mind without drugs. And I remember they were fried eggs, and you know, the ones on drugs were scrambled. Right? Remember that?
Well, yeah, but they didn't work.
Well, I thought I still eat scrambled eggs. I think scrambled eggs are pretty good.
But I mean, the attack there was that these were stupid and that they didn't keep people off drugs.
Let's talk about smoking ads, you know, where they show disgusting lungs, you know, that are kind of falling out and they're black, and this is what your lungs look like on smoking. Do you think they were effective?
I don't know. I mean, we're not smoking as much as we used to.
But some of the ads were effective. You know, the ads of, like, you know, the lobbyist for the smoking industry who was then dying of lung cancer. I found that very effective. But, of course, I'm not a smoker. I'm an adult, so I don't know whether or not kids found it effective. Some of the effective ads are when you have major groups, like rock star groups, that do something on the ad. You know, that's where the connection comes in. But obesity is not just for children. It's an adult thing. And the ads they're showing don't show people overweight.
Yeah. But how can you attack the problem of obesity with ads by not showing overweight people?
The concept behind it is that small steps make a difference. And the reality is this is a Clinton, not a Hillary, a Bill Clinton initiative. When he, in his dumb and stupid way, and I can say that, ignored the symptoms that he had and finally made it to the hospital and needed emergency bypass surgery, you know, he saw the light and said, what do I do? And began changing his habits. And it's actually small changes that actually make a big change in weight. And small changes are 150 to 200 calories a day, which is not much, can be the difference of 10 pounds of weight at the end of a year. And so the idea was, well, let's tell people to do small steps, and maybe that'll work. But these ads are namby-pamby. I think they're telling people eat better food. But the fact is, that's not it. You got to eat less better food that does it too. So I give the ads a D.
Yeah.
I think it's a D minus.
On the newscasts, whenever there's a news issue having to do with obesity, all you see is from the neck down really heavy people walking up and down the street. You've seen those news.
Absolutely.
So maybe we get enough of that on the news. We don't have to do it in the ads.
But maybe what you need is you need the ads, and then you take it so you can't see their eyes. You know, they blacken out the eyes.
Yeah.
Maybe what we should do is show heavy people with blackened eyes. But I'll tell you where the problem is. The problem is you may be a little overweight, and then you see somebody who's really overweight, and you go, well, I'm not that overweight, so it doesn't connect to me.
This isn't the problem for me. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, it's not like smoking where everyone smokes and it's one thing. It's that where is obesity, and it's a broad range. Nonetheless, I'm not an advertising executive. I think the ads are not good.
1-800-462-7413. That's our toll-free number. So if you want to talk with Zorba, give it a call. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hi, doctor. Thanks for taking my call.
What's up?
I have 5 children at home, and when it cold season comes around, it can really just take months to work its way through our family. And so we have relied heavily on decongestants in the past, and they've been in the news a lot frequently. I'm reading things and hearing stuff on the radio about the safety of decongestants for small children. Can you help me out a little bit there with, tell me if they really work as their build, and are there any alternatives?
Well, you actually had a point that's near and dear to my heart. Decongestants and cold remedies. First of all these things came on the market before they were tested. I mean, this stuff has been grandfathered in, and what happened was the FDA rules changed in the early 70s, and then they changed again in the 80s and in the 90s, and what they did was grandfather, quote, in old medications. They didn't have to be tested as safe and effective, and the FDA didn't give a sunset clause to it, didn't say, well, you know, if they're not tested within 10 years, they're off the market. They just sort of kept on grandfathering them, and the reason is because it's a lot of money. You know, you're talking about a multi-billion dollar a year business with major companies, Ortho McNeil and others that are in it. And also, then on the other end, you have parents who want to give something to their kids. So finally, the FDA panel said, no cold remedies to children under 6, period. That's it. And the reason was between 1996 and 2006, there had been roughly about 50, 60 deaths from antihistamines and decongestants, up to 100 deaths. That's the known death cause. Well, I mean, if you're giving your child a decongestant, you assume it's going to be safe, and you end up with your child being really sick or dead because of something that doesn't work. That's terrible. Yeah. And so the FDA said, let's stop this.
Well, yeah, where was the FDA for the last 20, 25 years or so, whatever it's been?
Right,
I mean,
exactly.
If these things don't do any good for any kid, and that's what now they're saying, how come they've been on the counter all these years? That's almost criminal.
Yeah, it's almost criminal. I agree with you 100%. Well, and the reason is because there's big money on here and no one was looking at it. Nobody's watching at it. You're right. It's almost criminal. Now, the issue is they didn't take all the cold remedies off the market. What they did was they said, let's look at children under six. Let's start there. And let's look at the devices that they're in. And what happens is many of the deaths come from overdose. And they overdose because the parents give them an overdose because they read the bottle. And the bottles are not consistent. They're all different. One's a dropper. One's a spoon. So you use a spoon and a bottle that uses a dropper, and you give two or three times or four times the dose. And that's where the issue comes in.
And our caller is asking, what's the alternative?
Well, there are a few things. First of all, if there are cold remedies in the house for children with droppers, throw them out. Put them in the garbage. Get rid of it. Done. Finished. Yeah. Everyone should do that. Get rid of it. Don't save it for another time when your child is sick. They don't work. Get rid of them. That's number one. Mm. Number two, if you're going to use any remedy, the remedies that you should use are first do no harm, something we say primum non nocere. So that means, for instance, your child is sick, get a vaporizer and put it in the room. Okay, if your child, little child that's congested, a little infant, you get a bulb syringe and it's a little uncomfortable. You suck the mucus out of the nose. Babies have trouble with mucus in the nose because they breathe through the nose for the first year, year and a half of their lives. You can put nose drops in the nose that are saline. They're just salt water. They're okay. They're safe to use. If you're going to give your child a remedy, make it a natural remedy such as honey and water. It's the syrup that goes down the throat. Honey and lemon, my mother used to give. It's that syrup that makes your child feel good, and give your child that most important folk remedy that has been there for years, that has been proven scientifically to work, chicken soup. And for the vegans out there, veggie broth. It's that TLC that works, and that's basically what you should do, and take the remedies and toss them.
Do I hear one of your five in the background there?
No, you don't. That's one of my coworkers.
Oh.
You know, I have to come to work to get a little peace.
Well, I'm sorry I mistook him or her
Gotta
for a little baby.
Gotta watch out for those coworkers.
Would never be this quiet at home.
All of this applies to your coworker as well, what Zorba was just saying.
Chicken soup. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Sure, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
800-462-7413. Zorba, let's take a note now from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox, signed only as Chicken Crazy. It reads, this question is about Michaela, a 10-year-old, normal, healthy, well-behaved girl. However, whenever she eats chicken, no matter if it's frozen, fast food, or fresh, she gets hyper. I was wondering if anything in chicken makes preteen girls a little loopy.
Well, wait a second. Preteen girls, by definition,
you're not going to say are loopy. No,
absolutely.
No, but
Michaela
isn't. Michaela is. He says here, Michaela is not loopy, except when she eats chicken.
Uh-huh. Well, there's nothing in the chicken.
There is too.
I mean,
Michaela eats it, she gets loopy. What's in it?
Okay, tryptophan.
That's
maybe
in
it's
turkey.
It's also in chicken.
Is it?
Maybe that's it. Maybe it's tryptophan. Let's blame it on tryptophan.
We're
going to blame it on tryptophan.
Tryptophan's supposed to make you calm and sleepy.
Yeah.
I've got it wrong.
Oh, sorry. I guess it's not the tryptophan. Maybe it's because they sit down and they you know something? There's no explanation for why this child is loopy. Maybe the dad is loopy when he eats chicken. I don't know. You know what? They've stumped the doctor.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to see if they stumped the co-host as well. Maybe there's something visually
in the chicken.
Yeah.
Oh, I've got it. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
I've got it. She's a coming-out vegetarian. That's our answer.
If some lifestyle question is driving you crazy, send it to us. Just address your comments, questions, and tips to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have so much more coming up. We have some more research coming up. We have our medical myth buster having to do with a flu shot coming up. Hang around here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, that toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Back to your calls after our recipe. And right now, we will welcome in Zorba buddy of yours, McCall, Idaho listener Les Bechtol with Canyon's Couscous. Les, hi. Zorba, you know this guy.
Yes, absolutely. I went on a couple of trips with you. It's wonderful. I remember the food, and I used some of these recipes.
What kind of trip?
Trips. White water rafting.
Oh, I knew you did it.
How long have you been doing that?
Oh, for over 30 years now.
Oh, my God. Over 30 years. I can't. What'd you start when you were 10 or something like that?
No, I'm pushing 60 right now.
So Les is your tour guide on the...
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things I remember, besides the incredible, beautiful scenery of the Middle Fork of the Salmon River and the Main Fork of the Salmon River, and the scenery is dynamite, but I remember the scenery when I'm eating this delicious food, which is wonderful food for anyone who camps out, that I think is dynamite.
Yeah, now, Les, are you always having to pull Zorba out of the water on these trips? How does he do?
No, he did great, but what impressed me was, for a little guy, he sure ate a lot.
There you go. That's because the food is good. So what I like about the recipes that you've developed, and we're going to talk about that, and we're going to put other recipes, a lot of camping dishes on the website, is you can take it camping. It's simple. It's delicious. It lasts for a while. And I think that's what you perfected over this 30-year period that you've been doing this.
That's right. You know, it's one thing to cook for four or six people in your home, but then it's another to cook for 30 people when the wind's blowing and the water's high and everybody's hungry.
Yeah, and right. And you're limited as to the amount of food you can carry on these trips.
That's right. I mean, the rafts will carry quite a bit, and we use a lot of fresh ingredients because we can carry big coolers, but there are limits to what you can bring.
Now, Tom, have you ever gone whitewater rafting?
No, I'd like to.
Yeah, well, you got to sign up and
do
something like that.
Except,
yeah.
I have to eat stuff like couscous? I mean, can I get some good food?
Peanut butter. There's always peanut butter.
Are there any fast food joints along the way?
No, you're stuck with what we serve you.
There we go. You are stuck. Well, let's start with this recipe. This is a fabulous dynamite recipe. And once again, I've used a number of these recipes. And these recipes are not just for camping. You know, lots of us go out. We've got soccer practice with our kids. We've got holiday buffets that we're going to. We've got pass a dish at any kind of a party. And what's nice is it's nice to bring something that's different, that's heart healthy, that's good, that's delicious, and tastes good. And I think this is a great recipe.
As we go through the ingredients, Les, feel free to jump in and explain or amplify or contradict or whatever, okay?
Yeah. Now, is there any story, by the way, around this particular recipe? I mean, couscous is not a common thing in America. Common, obviously, in Morocco and other places, but not in the U.S. Any particular story with this recipe?
We just sort of discovered it's fast, it's simple, and it's just easy to cook. It's hard to mess this one up.
I like it. Fast, easy, simple, hard to mess up. Let's start. Start out with two medium yellow onions diced.
Two medium yellow onions diced.
Now, I would assume you could add red onions if you wanted a bit of color to this. You know, that would be something you could use with this, too. You know,
reds. A lot of times red onions fade out when they're cooked.
Uh-huh.
And they don't carry the color. they're okay for like a salad or something like that.
You know, that's very interesting. So you just taught me something that I didn't realize. I mean, when I do them, I tend to add onions at the very end. But if you're in a recipe, if it's in a recipe like this, it'll fade out and you lose why you're using, you know, the reason you're using the red onions. Yeah. So, okay, so two medium yellow onions diced, 2 cloves of garlic minced.
2 cloves of garlic minced.
You know, and if you're like me, you can always add more garlic.
Mm-hmm, me too.
A jar, 7.5 ounce jar of sun-dried tomatoes packed in oil.
A jar of chopped sun-dried tomatoes packed in oil.
That's right. So you came to this. I mean, I've seen sun-dried tomatoes that are sort of dried out and ones that are packed in oil. So this is the oil of the recipe comes from this, correct?
That's right. You can buy sun-dried tomatoes more often than not in envelopes, and they're totally dried out. They take a while to reconstitute, and they don't carry the flavor that those packed in oil. But here's a tip for your listeners. The oil that these vegetables are packed in is incredibly flavorful. It's usually high-grade olive oil. And why throw it away? You know, use it. Save money.
Use it, save money, and it's also something you're thinking about on a camping trip. You want to use everything that you have. You don't want to waste anything because you brought it in. And you bring up a good point. The oil carries flavor with it, and, of course, that's what we're looking for. A dash of cayenne pepper.
A dash of cayenne pepper.
That's right. A half teaspoon of salt.
Half a little tea salt.
3 cups of water.
3 cups of water.
2 cups of couscous.
2 cups of couscous.
You know, I don't know if our listeners know, but couscous, what do you think couscous is, Tom? You've had couscous,
well,
right?
Well, it's rice-like, but you've told me before and I've forgotten. It's not rice.
It's pasta.
Pasta.
That's right. Tiny pasta. And yeah. I thought couscous was a grain. I thought it was rice-like for years. And then one day, that's right, I laughed the same way. When did you learn that couscous was pasta? Or did you know that all along?
I actually did some research because we had some failures with cooking with pasta for large groups. And I discovered couscous is incredibly easy to
failures.
Cook with.
So failures on the trip or failures off the trip?
No, unfortunately, during a trip. we used to try to do spaghetti because everybody loves spaghetti.
Mm-hmm.
And one time in my early years, I cooked a batch of spaghetti for 30 people, drained it very carefully, added a little olive oil, and set it aside while I had to tend with the sauce and other side dishes. And about 10 minutes later, when I came back, it was one huge gelatinous ball. And I was looking at a lot of hungry people, so I carefully cut it up quickly with my knife and fork and then served it as such. And a small child who was kind of fussy asked, well, what is this kind of pasta? What do you call this? And I made up a name. I said, oh, this is pixie pasta. The child loved it and went on and ate it all.
Pixie pasta.
I love it. So you've then morphed into couscous, which is pasta, obviously. So this is, if you don't like couscous, you'll like this because it's pixie pasta, Tom.
Oh.
That's what this is, a variation of.
Hey, I'm not 3 years old. That ain't going to work for me.
It's not going to work. And a half bunch of fresh cilantro chopped. And once again, people like cilantro. Some people don't. You could use parsley in something like this, and I think it would add some interesting taste. I happen to be a cilantro lover. So, okay, so let's make the recipe. So in a large pot, saute onions, garlic, and the tomatoes in oil. That's the oil we're using from the jar of sun-dried tomatoes until the onions are translucent. Doesn't take too long. About how long does that take when you do this? A couple minutes?
Five minutes.
5 minutes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's about 5 minutes. Add the cayenne pepper and salt. Then add the water. Bring it to a boil now. When it's at a boil, add the couscous. Simmer for 5 minutes. Very important because on the box of couscous, it usually says add it and stop. You know, not simmer. So I think that's an important part of this recipe. Simmer for 5 minutes until the water's absorbed. Fluff with a fork, garnished with the chopped cilantro. It's simple. It's easy. Serves 10 people. That's only 92 calories, roughly 100 calories a serving. Very low fat, 3 grams of fat. It's the good type of fat. It's delicious. You could have this with a little bit of chicken on the side. Anything else?
No, now you got my attention. Now I have this image, Les, of you putting this together while the raft is bouncing around and all the and the everybody is trying to hang on. Obviously, you have to stop, right? I mean, you're on the river. You can't do this.
Tom, you have the wrong image here. No, we bounce along the river all day, and then we stop. We change clothes, make camp, get comfortable, have appetizers, And then we have the couscous.
See, Tom thinks of the raft as a lifeboat from Titanic in the ocean going down while you've got to cook and feed these people. You bounce all day, and then you relax and have a little wine or a little beer or have a little soft drink if they had a little tea, and then you enjoy
it. This sounds good to me. Can you get chicken in those coolers, Les?
Oh, yeah. Okay. One of the things we always try to do is have a meat entree.
Uh-huh.
But not necessarily fix it with the main dish.
Uh-huh.
That way we appeal to the vegetarians or people who just don't like meat, and they can pick and choose as they go through the buffet line.
It sounds great. Sounds wonderful. This is a wonderful recipe. We're going to have lots of other camping recipes that you're going to give us on our website, which is absolutely great. And I want to thank you so much for being on the show. It's really great, and I hope to get Tom there someday to take a trip down the river.
I was just going to say,
if you can
put up with me for a few days at a time, Zorba.
Maybe we'll do it.
I handle Zorba for 6 days. I can take care of you, Tom.
Les, thanks a lot.
You bet.
And for sending us this winning recipe, Les gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low Fat, Guilt Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's easy. Just email your original low fat recipe to us at
Zorba@WPR.org.
For today's recipe, send a stamped, self-addressed, business-sized envelope to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, zip 53706.
And if you want this recipe to go, just go to our website. You can sign up for our weekly recipe podcast and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor on Your Health recipes. Remember, that's zorbapastor.org.
(800) 462-7413 is our toll-free number. That's 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, a listener with us now in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hey, guys. How you doing today?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I've got a question for Zorba, kind of a strange food allergy, and I wanted to know if you might be able to shed some light on it for me.
Mm-hmm.
I've got an allergy that seems to manifest after I eat most kinds of beans, with the exception of a garbanzo bean, so any kind of pinto beans, kidney beans, black beans, etc. And then also a fair amount of beer and almost every white wine I've ever had. And it begins with a kind of a closing up of my throat, and it seems to come in spasms or waves of sorts, and it's kind of a distinct pressure, have difficulty swallowing. But the thing that I find most confusing is, and I kind of stumbled on this with some dumb luck, a drink or two of whiskey seems to make it go away almost invariably. Usually by the time I'm done my first whiskey drink, the problem's completely gone. No matter how bad it was, it just goes away completely. And I have no idea what causes this or why whiskey is somehow the psychosomatic solution I've come up with.
Well, maybe you just take the shot and then you don't really care about it and finish the rest of the meal.
Well, it's complicated. I'm eating breakfast burritos in the morning, certainly. So.
Breakfast burritos and a shot of whiskey at McDonald's, it's not going to work. It's not going to be the same thing. Well, there are a couple things. First of all, let's look at the beer as a specific thing.
Okay.
A number of people are sensitive to wheat.
It's pretty haphazard how it occurs. I found Corona typically is my safest ally when it comes to beer drinking. Guinness is an absolute disaster, but at the same time, sometimes I get away with it, sometimes I don't. So I can actually have a Guinness every so often and come out unscathed, but 9 times out of 10, Guinness is going to blow up in my face, and the next thing you know, I've got to get a whiskey drink stat.
Whiskey drink stat to save you.
Corona. Yeah, most times I'm okay with Corona. Every so often, though, that gets me a little bit.
So is this related? What are you eating when you have the beer? Is it a beer where you're eating food with it that's doing it? Is it the other food you have, or is it just on an empty stomach?
It's kind of all across the board. I mean, I guess if I probably could clinically look back and think about it more specifically, maybe sometimes where Corona was an issue, I might have been eating something that had another thing that got me set off. So I think you might be on the right track there. I just need to better watch what I eat and drink.
Well,
at the same
and this may be, this is a relative of an allergic response. So let me tell you a couple of things that actually may make a difference. There actually is a medical cocktail that works for people who have this happen every time they drink wine and beer and so on. And it consists of one aspirin tablet, full-strength aspirin tablet, a Claritin tablet, over-the-counter generic Claritin, 20 milligrams. That's 2 Claritin tablets. And then a prescription. If that doesn't work, you add a prescription drug called Singular. which you have to get from your doctor. It's a prescription drug, and it's a 10-milligram tablet. And that will usually break the response before you have it. So if you know you're going to go out, you're going to party on a Friday night, take an aspirin and take 2 Claritin, and that may work for you. That alone may do it. And if not, you add a drug called Singular, because what you're having is an allergic-type response. It's a similar response to what you get when you get an allergic reaction. And what you want to do is attenuate that and tamp that down. Now, you've discovered it doesn't happen all the time. Just like allergies, they don't happen all the time. You can get away with it. It's dose-specific. It may be the amount you're drinking. It may be specific to the kind, as you said. You know, Guinness will tend to do you in, and the other will not. It's related to the food that you're eating. So you got to kind of find the food, but that medical cocktail might work for you.
And that's all safe with alcohol.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, it's safe with alcohol as long as you don't get in the car and drive.
Right.
You know, that's the issue.
Right.
That's always the issue with alcohol. So well, good luck. And like I said, you know, 2 whiskeys 4 times a day, that'll change your life.
Is that a solution for me? Sounds good to me.
Take care.
All right. Appreciate it, guys. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Before we get to the break, Zorba, let's grab a quick question from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This one comes to us from Mario in El Paso, Texas. Seems like Mario is having trouble sweating after he showers, and he would like to know if there's any soap he could use to prevent this perspiration.
Sweating after he showers.
So
he showers, gets out of the
and
shower, and then he sweats.
Now, to me, this
cold
is one of those.
Water.
This is one of those duh moments.
He's
writing us from El Paso, Texas,
which is
107 degrees.
Which is
so
hot.
Right. When he gets out of the shower,
he's hot.
Yeah,
he's hot. That's exactly it.
But maybe,
wait a minute.
Maybe that's not
it.
Maybe he lives in an air conditioned place. And
no. You've given the advice. It's the Tom Clark Show. Stay tuned for Tom Clark, who gives advice on common medical problems. I'm Zorba Pastor. Let's go on. Thank you, Tom.
Let's see if we can help him out. Maybe it's an air conditioned bathroom, and he still sweats after he showers.
Well, part of the issue
is there soap change?
First of all, it's the heat of the shower. If he's getting out of a hot shower, he's going to sweat. So what you do is you cover yourself with cold water when you get out. I mean, I'm serious. That may be what it is. If you're sweating when you get out, it's probably because the water's too hot. You know, it's a shower that you're used to. You're over there, and you're heating up your body in the shower. And if you cool it off before getting off, that can make a difference. But for some people, they still have residual sweat. And for those people, the answer is powder, talcum powder, cornstarch, some sort of powder when they get out. And that's what they do. Because, frankly, some people do sweat when they get out of the shower, even with cold water. Powder is the solution.
It's no sweat for us to answer your questions and comments. Just keep them coming. Send us your thoughts in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some research coming up, our flu shot medical myth buster. More of your calls, too, here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, our number, 1-800-462-7413. And we'll be back to the phones after, I think, Zorba, some disconcerting research on Alzheimer's and education.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this study is very disconcerting. It shows that having more years of formal education, better educated people, although they may delay the onset of Alzheimer's, once they get it, it becomes rapidly worse. And the degeneration that occurs in their ability to function seems to be snowballed by education, which is sort of flies in the face of what we know about education and Alzheimer's in the first place.
Does this study show us anything as to why this might be?
No, not at all. We know, for instance, that well-educated people, people who have a college education or an advanced education, have a delayed onset to Alzheimer's disease. And we think it's kind of like learning a computer program. For instance, if you want to print on the computer screen. You can use the mouse. You can use two or three keystrokes and so on. So you've got different memory traces for one action. And it's kind of the same with Alzheimer's. We think if you're educated, you have different memories all over to do something. But the question is, once you actually show signs of Alzheimer's, it appears, at least from this study, that it may be doom and gloom, that indeed things will get much worse much quicker.
Is this a large study, a good study?
It's a good study. It's a small study. It only took place in New York. It only took place in the Bronx. So, I mean, it works with a defined group of people. But once again, it's sort of another issue in the puzzle of Alzheimer's disease. Where does education fit a role? And it may be that once you develop the signs of Alzheimer's, if you're educated, you're already advanced. In other words, we can't really measure the advancement that's going on in the brain with Alzheimer's, and what they may be looking at is not cause and effect, but once you're educated and you have Alzheimer's, your Alzheimer's is pretty bad by that time. We know from the nun study of nuns that nuns who developed educational ways of looking at things and doing crossword puzzles and engaged in good activities were less likely to show signs of Alzheimer's disease as they got older. So we know that from that study. And this study, though, shows once they get it, it may be much worse.
So maybe you're actually, in a way, getting Alzheimer's at the usual rate, but it isn't as evident that you have Alzheimer's.
You've got it. That is exactly my read from the study. Now, I have a personal issue with me. My mom had Alzheimer's disease. I'm worried about Alzheimer's. I'm worried about all forms of dementia, so my blood pressure is kept under control. Very important. Alcohol is moderate. A drink a day, 2 drinks max. I'm not really a drinker, so that's easy to do. I take a vitamin tablet with folic acid. I take an extra 1 milligram of folic acid that may prevent Alzheimer's disease. I take an anti-inflammatory drug, Aleve, 2 tablets a day. That may help prevent Alzheimer's disease. And I'm going to continue learning because I know that delays the onset. This study may show that for somebody who is a lifelong learner, once they have symptoms, it means their Alzheimer's is advanced.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. That's 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, a listener joins now from Califon, New Jersey. Hi.
Hi there. Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba.
What's up?
Well, I have a question. I have my third child just turned one a couple of weeks ago.
Happy birthday to him or her.
He's a he. His name is Gavin.
Mm-hmm.
And Gavin, a few months ago, started developing body odor. Like, really body odor, not like, you know, kind of a sour-smelling baby, but he's a fresh, you know, smelling little guy, except as it got hot, as the summer, you know, started kicking in, he started really getting stinky.
At 1 year of age?
Yeah, and it's under his arms. It's definitely body odor.
Wow.
So the question is this a dietary thing? Is this a endocrinological kind of a thing? Is it something that this is how he is, or is this something I need to, I mean, I've looked this up in all my medical books, and I don't know what it is.
Right. And you've talked to your doctor about this?
I haven't. Mm-hmm. I actually haven't, because I was basically thinking it's just odd, but over the last month or so, I've been asking other parents, and no one has heard of this, so it occurred to me I may want to ask a doctor, and that was...
You mean nobody else has a stinky child?
Nobody else has a stinky child. No.
So in other words, he smells good like a fresh baby sometimes. You know, and there's that certain smell. You know, I have to admit, some of the smell I associate, I think, with the Johnson & Johnson products, you know, that have their own perfume to them. And so when I think of babies, I think sometimes that's what I think of, because the reality, that's the smell that I often bathe them in. But you're talking about something that smells like an apocrine gland, which is not developed in your baby.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but it's definitely body odor. It's body odor. It's stinky.
Mm-hmm. And not coming from the mouth.
No, mm-hmm. No, it's under his arms.
Uh-huh. Is there any rash involved at all?
No rash involved.
Uh-huh. Well, first of all, I'm not sure precisely what's going on, but if there's no rash involved and you look under your arm, the baby's arm, and you know, everything looks okay, you don't see anything that develops. I mean, I'm thinking of any endocrine disease that would cause this, and I can't think of anything. You know, it's in a child that's older, you think it may be premature puberty. It's not happening in a one-year-old.
Right.
Obviously not for that. What I think I would do is I would treat it locally with some powder. And then when next time I see your doctor, I'd have your doctor look. But I don't know what this is. I'm not sure why the smell is occurring, but I don't think you have a disease state. I don't think you have a problem. I'd mention it at the next well baby visit. But frankly, I'm not sure why it's occurring. And I'd also look to see whether or not it's occurring with certain clothing.
Some clothing holds
moisture in longer, and some clothing itself can develop a smell from the clothing even when you wash it. So I would look at clothing. I would use cotton shirts and see, hey, when my child has this clothing on, my child doesn't smell. When my child has this clothing on, it does smell. So what you're looking at is sort of excretion-type odors that are coming from the body that may be wicked up into the polyester that you may be dressing your child in. So I would use pure cotton, see what happens, see if it's related to that. And if so, then what you're looking at is basically sort of a history of accretions that come from the body that are then smelling, and it may not be the baby.
I got it. Okay.
Okay. And do call us back and let us know.
Yeah.
I'm very
curious.
Well,
thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the
call.
Welcome. This is unusual, isn't it?
Very unusual. I want to know what happens. We're going to revisit this. Yeah. We will revisit this.
Zorba, let's get to our medical myth buster. Today's myth has to do with getting your flu shot. Many people still believe that getting vaccinated causes a case of the flu. Are they right to worry?
They are wrong to worry. They are wrong. It is a myth that the flu shot can give you the flu. And the reason is it's an attenuated dead vaccine. There's nothing live within the flu shot. You can't get it. The vaccine is dead. There's no virus within there at all, so you can't get it. Now, what are the side effects of the vaccine? Well, the most common side effect of the vaccine is pain, right?
Yeah.
Where you get it. Does everybody get it? 1% of the people, 2%. I mean, the flu shot doesn't hurt like a tetanus shot.
Yeah.
Tetanus shots hurt. And generally, if you look at the pain from a tetanus shot, about 90% of the people have some pain from that. Mm-hmm. The shingles shot, new shingles shot hurts. But, you know, pain is, you know, it's a little pain. People don't like injections because of the pain. But from a point of view of getting the flu, you don't.
Yeah, well, this is an ignorant question because I'm ignorant on this issue. If there's nothing live in there, then how does that protect you from getting the flu?
Well, what happens is your body looks at it. It looks at what are called antigenic particles within there, and it says, oh, this looks like a virus here. In fact, it isn't there. It's proteins that are floating around. I better do something about it, and it develops antibodies to those proteins that are floating around in the body, even though there's no virus.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, it develops antibodies, if you will, to the coat, to the things that are floating around that are the antigenic particles. It induces the body to think there's a virus there when in fact there isn't a virus.
Yeah.
Now, remember, when you get it, some people do have a reaction to the shot, and the reaction may be a little fever, and they might not feel very good, and the fever is usually like a half a degree higher. But it's not the flu itself. You know, if they come down with something a day later that's a full-blown cold, it's a different virus. It's not a flu. It's a cold virus.
I get the flu shot every year. The last time I got it, I got the flu shot in one arm and a pneumonia shot in the other arm. That pneumonia shot knocked me on my butt.
Yeah.
You talk about side effects. I couldn't lift my arm for the rest of the day.
Right.
I did. I had a little bit of a fever. I was flushed.
Wow.
I just felt really crummy.
Yeah. Well, you only get the pneumonia shot once. That's all most people get it. So you had one shot. You felt bad for a day or two.
Oh.
It protects you against many forms of pneumonia. You got to do the payoff.
Well, pneumonia shot 4 or 5 years ago. Should I not have gotten this pneumonia
shot?
Well,
there's now a new shot, so I don't know what you had for your old shot. But once you get the new shot, you don't need it unless you're in a certain circumstance where you've lost your spleen or you have another medical problem. It's for most people, it's a one-shot event. And most people don't get the reaction. But you bring up a good point. You get these reactions and you go, I'm not going to have any shots. I get reactions to them and they bother you. And then you avoid getting immunized, which I think is an important part of safety in our society.
Yeah, but bottom line on this medical myth, you can't get the flu from the flu shot.
There you go.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust? Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our toll-free number for you is 800-462-7413. And Zorba, we have a listener with us now in Princeton, New Jersey. Hi.
Hi, guys.
What's up?
I am a new mom. My daughter is now 11 weeks old. And I have recurring eczema or psoriasis. I get contradictory diagnoses on it. And I'm wondering how I can best treat it while nursing.
Well, first of all, the rash of psoriasis is different from the rash of eczema. You can't have both. And if you want to look at the rash of psoriasis, go to the website, write down rash of psoriasis. You used to have to go to a doctor and look in a picture book in the doctor's office. But frankly, the web is just wonderful for this. And they'll show you there's a gray-colored scale that may be on top of the rash. And they're different things. They occur often in different areas of the body, too. The treatment for both, initial treatment for both, is often a steroid cream, a mild steroid cream that in certain areas of the face, around the lips, around the nose, it's a different steroid cream, and a mild to medium potency steroid cream in other parts of the body. And often for people with mild psoriasis and mild eczema, usually that works pretty well.
And that's okay while nursing?
Yeah, usually, yeah. But those creams are okay. They're really not absorbed into the body. You say you get contradictory advice, meaning what?
I've seen several different dermatologists in the past few years because I've moved around a bit, and sometimes I've been told it's eczema, and sometimes I've been told it's psoriasis, but I always seem to get very quickly the same kind of prescription for a topical steroid.
Right, and that's because a topical steroid works in both. If you go, and I'll tell you, this is a good example where you can advocate for yourself. Go to a website, go to a good website like mayoclinic.org, I think it is, maybe .com, but go to the Mayo Clinic website, go to the FDA website, go to a university, another good university website like the University of Wisconsin, but pick a top-notch website. American Dermatological Association also has a website. And look up psoriasis and look up eczema, look at the rash, and look at where it occurs in the body because it tends to occur in different parts, in different creases of the body, if you will. And become an expert and look at where your rash is. Then the next time you go into the doctor and you say, "Doctor, what do I have? Is it eczema or is it psoriasis?" And the answer is you may have both. But the cream is often the same as the initial treatment. So it doesn't really matter from a treatment point of view.
Okay.
How old is your baby?
11 weeks.
Oh, how wonderful. How wonderful. What's the name?
Elizabeth.
I wonder if she's gorgeous.
Oh, she is.
Well, good luck with Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Zorba, thank you.
A pleasure, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
Don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Our head honcho is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Radiohead Kohlberg is our technical director, and Gigi Holland gets our recipes to you. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
National support for Zorba Pastor on Your Health comes from the AED Superstore, helping people save lives with Philips HeartStart automated external defibrillators for business, school, travel, and home. Available at AEDSuperstore.com. Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1101Z.
PRI, Public Radio International.